A Garment Worker's Dilemma, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The head of the Garment Manufacturers Association in Bangladesh says sexual harassment is impossible there.
This is a Muslim country. Here, sexual harassment is very difficult because everybody is pious. So no man will think that he will harass a woman.
Female garment workers in Bangladesh disagree. Also, the Chumash firefighter battling the Thomas Blaze and preserving his tribal heritage. Plus, a brief history of synthesized voices.
That sounded awfully flat. How about a little expression? Who saw you?
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being here this Friday. About 2 weeks away from the end of the year, 2017 has been the year of women saying no to sexual harassment and assault in the workplace, often risking a lot to speak out, not just here in the U.S., but in many other parts of the globe as well. We're a show that connects across boundaries, so today we start with one woman's story of harassment from halfway around the world. And it's a story that shows how risky speaking out can be for women, especially poor women who simply can't afford to lose their jobs or whose lives could be in big danger if they speak out. Our Across Women's Lives correspondent Jasmine Garz was recently in Bangladesh reporting on women in the garment industry. And while she was there, she stumbled upon a case of sexual harassment. Jasmine joins me now. Welcome, Jess.
Hi, Marco.
So how did you discover this story of sexual harassment in Bangladesh?
I actually wasn't looking for it. I was in Bangladesh doing a series about the garment industry, and I was talking to factory workers who, by the way, are overwhelmingly women. It's like 80%. Mm. And I was talking to them about safety conditions, and I was trying to find out if safety conditions have improved for them after a series of really high-profile, deadly, very gruesome accidents at the factories. Most of the women I spoke to said, yes, things have actually improved safety-wise. And then I met this young woman who is 19 years old.
আমারে বলছে মানে কি ধরেন এই জন্য আমারে এরকম করার কারণে আমারে 10 দিনকে সাসপেন্ডও রাখছিল এরকম করার কারণে মানে
So what this woman is saying is, you know, she works really long hours. All these women work really long hours and mistakes get made. And what she's saying is they get kind of berated when they make mistakes. But there's this one line manager who it's a known fact that if you let him touch you, if you let him be sexually suggestive with you, he'll look the other way on your mistakes. And this happened to her one day. She made a mistake and the line manager came to her and showed her how to redo it while holding her hand. And he did this several times. And she said, can you stop? Can you show me how to do things without touching me? And he said, listen, if you don't like it, the doors are over there. And she took it to his boss, and he said the same thing. If you don't like it, the doors are over there. In fact, she got suspended for 10 days for complaining.
We're obviously withholding her name. This is just one worker, though. How widespread is the problem?
So it is one allegation, but it concerned me. And what I did was I reached out to someone named Nisha Varia. She's an advocate for women's rights at Human Rights Watch. And here's what she told me.
We found instances where workers were being coerced into sleeping with managers. And, you know, this is all in the context where there aren't many employment options. You know, this is what they depend on to feed their families, to clothe their families, to send their kids to school. Women are really desperate not to lose their jobs.
So basically, Marco, what I found out is that it's pretty widespread. You know, there was a 2014 survey by Democracy International. They interviewed 1,508 workers at 150 factories. And I just want to stress, it's really hard to get into these factories. They don't like media in there. But of those workers they interviewed, 25% said they had experienced sexual harassment. It is a widespread problem.
Wow, a quarter of them. So in the case of the woman you spoke with, she went to various managers and not only got nowhere, she got suspended, as you said. Does she have any legal recourse?
You know, she also spoke to a workers' committee, which is kind of like a sort of union. Mm. And they told her, listen, we're here to make money, is what they told her. And if you keep quiet, you'll get a raise. Basically, don't start trouble. So really, no, there isn't much recourse for women like this. In fact, it got so far, Marco, that this woman, one day she graffitied with some of the other women. She wrote on the wall of the factory what this manager was doing. And she came in the next morning and it was being scrubbed away by a janitor. So eventually she quit her job.
Jasmine, how seriously does the garment industry in Bangladesh take these charges of sexual harassment?
While we were in Bangladesh, me and my producer, we reached out to the Bangladesh Garment Manufacturers and Exporters Association to the president, Mohammed Siddiqur Rahman. We went to his office and we wanted to ask, how worried is he about harassment?
There is no way to harass anyone because our brand is very strict on that. Our people are very strict on that. Our owners are very strict on that. So there is no harassment, no way. If she said that I am from that factory, this is not true. This is a Muslim country. Here sexual harassment is very difficult because everybody is pious. So no man will think that he will harass a woman.
You know, and Marco, I should add that he was beyond annoyed. He was very curt. He swatted our microphone out of his face.
That's kind of stunning. And what about downstream? Did distributors have anything to say about this?
So the factory where this woman works, or where she used to work because she quit over her allegations, one of the clothing retailers that buys from that factory is H&M. In fact, we did reach out to H&M and they responded, quote, H&M does not accept sexual harassment in any form. This is stated in our sustainability commitment. They gave us a much longer statement and we're going to post it on our website.
So how fair is your fashion? We found a way to show you a quiz that you can take to assess the fairness of the clothes you buy, clothes that you could very well be buying this weekend. That quiz is at PRI.org. Jasmine Garz with our Cross Women's Lives project. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
In Australia, an investigation into child abuse has exposed a national tragedy. That's how Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull described the revelations. Turnbull was referring to a 5-year inquiry that just published its final report, and the bottom line is disturbing, to say the least. The investigation found that Australian institutions seriously failed to protect children. Among the worst offenders, the Catholic Church. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
It's called a Royal Commission, the highest form of government investigation in Australia. And this one involved more than 8,000 testimonies from victims of abuse. The accusations go back decades, and they happened in a wide range of institutions, schools, sports clubs, foster homes, the military, and churches. Tens of thousands of children have been sexually abused, the report said. We will never know the true number.
I was sexually abused between the ages of 7 and 14 by 4 perpetrators. 2 of those were teachers, one at a Catholic institution, one was a Catholic priest, and another one was a Catholic brother.
Andrew Collins told his story to the BBC.
It was pretty much drummed into my head by the abusers that I was the person who had sinned. I was the one who had done wrong. I did try and tell my mother once, and she told me it was absolute rubbish, that, you know, a man of God would never do such a thing. And I also reported another abuse to a teacher who just told me to stay away from him. He's a pervert, but didn't do anything else.
The final report lays out extensive recommendations. It calls for a national strategy across Australia to prevent child abuse, including the creation of a new government office for child safety. It says failure to protect children from abuse inside of an institution needs to be made a criminal offense and calls for anyone in a religious ministry who commits abuse to be removed from that ministry permanently. Kathy Kesselman works with a survivor's support group and says the way to address the problem is more transparency in all kinds of institutions.
I think we've all been shocked by the systemic nature, and I think what it's done is shown Australia, at least, and hopefully the world, that this is not about individual perpetrators. This is about systems failure. And, you know, certainly we've seen systems where institutional risk minimization was prioritized over the welfare of children. And then victims who came forward who, instead of being supported and believed, were vilified and punished.
Tens of thousands of survivors may be eligible for some government compensation. The Catholic Archbishop of Sydney, Anthony Fisher, said that the victims must receive justice.
I think whatever the cost, we have to address this fully. We have to be ready to give whatever it takes to bring healing and justice and compassion to the victims. And of course, the churches have already been doing this for some time now. There's been processes in place and there's been court judgments and so on. And we know there'll be more of that ahead. And I say that we stand ready to do what is just and compassionate in this area.
Catholic leaders in Australia repeated their unconditional apology today. But the government inquiry recommends that the Catholic Church take some dramatic steps. One, get rid of its celibacy requirement for clergy. And two, make priests report any allegations of child abuse to authorities, even when they come up during private confessions. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Let's check in now with our language desk. Nina Porzucchi co-hosts our podcast about language, The World in Words. Hey, Nina.
Hello, Marco. How's your Friday going?
Wait a second. You're not Nina.
No, I'm Nina's digital voice. Nina's a little late today. Wait, here she comes.
Thanks, Nina Bot. Okay, here's the real deal.
Thanks, Nina Bot.
Nina, what was that? What was I just listening to?
That was my voice clone, Marco. Isn't she great?
It's a little creepy.
Yeah, well, this week on the podcast, we're talking about speech synthesis. And lucky you, if you think that's creepy, you're going to meet your voice clone this hour.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. But, I mean, why would you want to clone your voice or any voice?
Well, there are many, many reasons. Like, what if you could recreate someone's voice who has lost it to a disease, like Roger Ebert? He lost his voice to cancer. Or what if you could create a voice for someone who's never had a unique voice of their own, like Stephen Hawking? And then, get this, what if you could speak to a 13-year-old version of yourself?
Like a prepubescent version?
Yes. So this week on the podcast, we're going to profile a startup in Montreal called Lyrebird, and they are developing a technology to synthesize your voice with just 1 minute's worth of sound.
Lyrebird, as in you're lying to me, Nina?
No, I'm telling the truth, Marco. And it's lyre, as in L-Y-R-E, after the Australian bird who can mimic sounds.
That was a camera shutter. And now a camera with a motor drive. And that's a car alarm.
That's a bird
That's a bird.
Wow, that's incredible. It sounded like a car alarm.
Okay, so let's get started. We're going to synthesize your voice.
Wow. Is it going to hurt?
Maybe. We'll see.
Okay.
So to do that, I'm going to have you go to www.lyrebird.ai.
Okay,
okay,
I'm here.
Soon. Yeah.
Create your digital voice.
Exactly.
Click that.
Yep. So log on in.
Confirm password. I'm not a robot. And sign up.
Are you sure you're not a robot?
Now we're in.
Yes.
Now what do I do?
So what you're going to have to do is read a bunch of sentences into the computer, and you're going to record into the computer.
You'll have to read at least 30 sentences before being able to create your digital voice. Please click on Start Recording, read the following text, and click on Stop Recording. Okay. 18 months after the animal has been reported missing, it was finally in its owner's arms again. Validate?
Yeah, validate it. The next one. You have to do this 30 times.
It's easier to endure the cold if you have a warm drink in the belly. My roommate's boyfriend is taking up two shelves of fridge space with his beer.
That one's good.
Fascinating. I want to know more about that house. This is a very strange, disjointed story. I don't know where it's heading.
So hang in there, Marco. You're going to find out later in the show.
I am really curious now. Meanwhile, don't touch that dial. We'll be right back with the answer to this question. How bad are bitcoins for the environment? You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Let's talk Bitcoin for a few minutes and make the environmental connection. The value of this virtual currency is skyrocketing. A year ago, one Bitcoin was worth about $800. Today, it's close to $18,000. Serious dividends. But as Bitcoin's value climbs, so does the amount of energy being used to produce it. to explain how a currency that exists only in the cloud has a carbon footprint, and a really big one, let's turn to University of Cambridge cryptocurrency expert Garrick Heilman and our own Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler. Hello to both of you.
Hey, Marco.
Hi there.
Garrick, let me start with you. I and many others find Bitcoin really confusing, but for my own clarity, I've come up with this analogy, and tell me what you think. Possessing Bitcoin is like owning stock. There's a finite number of shares issued, and people can buy those shares and fractions of shares, and the value of them rises and falls. It's just that with Bitcoin, you don't own an actual stock. You own a piece of code that lives in the cloud. Is that a good analogy, or is there a better way to think about it?
I think that is a nice way of putting it. I mean, Bitcoin is often called a digital commodity. And so it often is compared to gold. It's sometimes referred to as digital gold because there's scarcity, it's fungible, divisible, and so it has properties that resemble some other assets that we're more familiar with.
And I've just learned that the process for getting new Bitcoin is called mining, but obviously it's not people with pickaxes down in a mine underground. How does new Bitcoin get produced? Like, what is mining Bitcoin? I'm using air quotes here. What does it actually look like?
Yeah, the term mining is helpful and I think also a little confusing. I think it was originally used to describe basically the search for new Bitcoins, similar to how miners go searching for new gold deposits. Basically, computers are competing against each other to solve a cryptographic puzzle. And the first computer that successfully solves that puzzle mines new Bitcoins into existence. They're paid new Bitcoins by the software itself. Currently today, there's a little under 17 million Bitcoins that have been produced through this mining process, but there's an upper limit of 21 million. Now, the number of new Bitcoins that come into existence gets cut in half every 4 years until we hit that 21 million limit sometime roughly 100 years from now.
All right, I'm going to stop getting granular here. Bitcoin, though, has gotten more expensive, and there's been this kind of arms race in computing power. You used to be able to mine it competitively with a home computer, and now there are these giant server farms all over the world doing it. Can you explain why more and more computer power is needed?
So Bitcoin relies on aggregate computing power to secure the network, to prevent it from being hacked, basically, from someone coming in and, say, double spending the same coin or even rearranging who owns what. So the more computing power applied to the Bitcoin network, the more resilient it is to a hack. And as the price of Bitcoin goes up, more computers are set up to mine Bitcoin. And the security increases because it's now harder to hack, which in turn makes it arguably more valuable. So it's a very cleverly designed system.
So Garrick, Carolyn here, basically as Bitcoin's value increases, it gets harder and harder to unlock and win new Bitcoins. So you need more and more computing power. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
So this is where I became interested as an environment reporter in Bitcoin, because you can think about Bitcoin as basically turning electricity into digital currency.
Right.
And a lot of these big server farms are located in China, and so you're basically taking coal-fired energy. So the past couple of weeks, I've been seeing a ton of headlines comparing the energy required to mine Bitcoin to the energy consumption of small countries. The electricity used to mine Bitcoin this year is bigger than the annual usage of 159 countries, and Bitcoin mining consumes more electricity a year than Ireland. But since there's no directory of Bitcoin miners and what kind of technology they're using and how much energy it uses, I was really curious about where these numbers are coming from.
So what'd you find, Carolyn? How do you even track numbers on this secretive currency?
So everything is an estimate, right? And there are big variations in how much energy different estimators think is being used. So most of the stories are citing the Bitcoin Energy Consumption Index, which the blogger who runs that basically figures out what percentage of revenues these miners are probably putting toward electricity. And then he's figuring out how much energy that represents. So he puts the amount of energy that's currently being used to mine Bitcoin as 33 terawatt hours of electricity per year, which is close to the energy consumption of the country of Denmark. So that's
incredible.
Where these country comparisons are coming from. Other people have found wildly different figures, though. For example, Garrick, your team at the University of Cambridge estimated back in April something around 4 terawatt hours per year. So it's about an eighth of that number that's super often cited these days.
Right. And thanks for mentioning that that was back in April. Back then, the price of Bitcoin was around 1,000. It's since gone up almost 18x. And so mining power has increased dramatically. So that definitely is an out-of-date figure.
And how does the Bitcoin energy footprint compare to more traditional payment systems?
So the amount of energy used by Bitcoin is a small fraction of what's used by the entire banking system. But few of us use Bitcoin, and many of us use the banking system. And then I was super curious how this digital currency compared to paper currency. So I found the figures for what it takes to produce a euro banknote. It takes about the same amount of energy as it would to keep a 60-watt light bulb on for about half an hour. To produce the same amount of Bitcoin, you need the energy that would be required to keep your entire house powered for 4 days.
That's amazing.
So the average American household. Now, that's looking at a 50-euro banknote because that's the most common one in circulation.
Thanks for crunching the numbers. Now, Garrick Heilman, what is the takeaway for you on Bitcoin and sustainability overall? Can Bitcoin ever be a sustainable currency option from an environmental perspective?
A lot of smart people are working hard on new security algorithms that would consume much lower amounts of energy than Bitcoin's current proof-of-work algorithm. You know, we expect to see in the next year or so one of these introduced on a major blockchain. If that doesn't happen, then Bitcoin's going to continue to consume a lot of energy, especially if the price continues to go up.
Garrick Heilman from the University of Cambridge and my colleague Carolyn Beeler from our Livable Planet Desk. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
The World's Nina Porzuki is back with me. She was here earlier on the show to tell us about this computer program that lets you create your digital voice clone.
That's right, Marco, and you are going to read some random sentences into the computer in order to do that. So keep on reading.
I got a feeling I'm going to get punked after this. Sorry, I stopped recording. Okay. This horse has more than one horsepower. Even an ordinary man has more than one horsepower, but gets tired quickly. History teaches us that humans do not learn from history.
It's true.
My puberty was probably taxing for mommy and daddy. Did you get the same sentences?
No, but that was so good. Oh, I love it. I love it so hard.
My puberty probably was taxing for mommy and daddy. Can we say that on the radio?
Okay, here we go. Two more. You called that number not 10 minutes ago.
Last one.
Smiling is just part of living a fulfilled life. Create my digital voice now.
So it takes about like a minute to do that. So in this minute, you got to think about what's the first sentence your digital voice is going to say. It's not just going to speak to you. It's like a text box that opens up and you can type in whatever you want and then make your voice clone say whatever you want. So
Wow. This
first sentence is very...
Very important.
Yeah.
This is kind of my mission statement.
Right. What are you going to say?
Yeah. What will I say? And what will I sound like? Stay tuned. Nina and I will be back later in the show, along with my voice clone. Can't wait to hear that.
Me neither.
I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. ordered 92 Somalis deported and put them on a plane, but it turned out to be a round-trip flight.
Conditions on the plane, of one of my colleagues characterized them as slave ship conditions. By the time they got back to the United States, of course, they were exhausted, having been in an airline seat, shackled hands and feet for nearly 2 days.
What happened? That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The wildfires that continue to rage in Southern California are not just a danger to human lives, property, and animals. Given where some of these fires have hit in the state, they also threaten indigenous culture. Of the more than 8,000 some firefighters battling the Thomas Fire in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties, count among them the members of the Chumash Fire Department. They're from the Santa Ynez Band of Chumash Indians. Gilbert Romero is a fire captain and cultural specialist for the Chumash FD. So you're at the reservation and getting ready to head back out to the fire about 15 miles away. How many sacred sites are you and your team concerned about, like right now?
As far as getting a hard number, I couldn't tell you that. I know that there is a couple hundred in the excess of, 500 just in my local area. But as we get further to the east out there in Ventura and where the fire started, I imagine there's about that, if not more. So probably double that number.
Incredible. So what is a sacred site, for example, that you're looking to protect?
Anything that's significant to, history of the tribe. Could be a working site. It could be an old village site, a burial site, or an area where indigenous people were traveling and stopped to camp overnight. Something that has the history kind of footprinted in that location is significant to our tribe.
So just in the context of fighting fires, you're a cultural specialist. What does that mean? What do you do?
So I'm in both worlds. I fight fire and I also do the cultural specialist job, which is to protect and preserve, you know, our history. So a typical day is going to the morning briefing, seeing where that fire activity is going to be, so we know what areas we're able to go in safe and which areas we want to stay clear of. We'll get our site records and compare that to the map of where we're going to be at for the day. We'll go check it out and see if there's any damage done to the site due to equipment or hand crews. There's been times where we've had to wrap whole big boulders with fire-resistant material, or we'll get a hold of folks that are leading the dozers in and tell them, hey, this area is sensitive, so can you maneuver the dozers around this to protect the site? So there's a lot of pre-planning involved, and it's tough because the cultural specialist isn't available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, like firefighters are.
And what happens, what do you do if there is damage to those sacred sites?
We can't really do anything other than document it. We're kind of the ones to bring what we're seeing out there back to the tribe and say, hey, this is what has been affected and this is, you know, sites that have been protected or lost.
Why did you decide to become a cultural specialist for the fire department? I've heard that your father did the same job.
He currently does the same job. He doesn't do it with the fire department. He actually works for the tribe. And that's what he does. He goes out to job sites where they may be moving earth and he makes sure that they don't, you know, damage a site. And he still does it to this day. And that's his love and his passion. And it's one of mine as well. As soon as I graduated high school, you know, my dad put me to work monitoring, going out protecting sites. It's just something that, you know, folks here on the reservation just grew up around. And now we're kind of getting paid to do it. But it's something that's close to our heart because we get to protect our heritage, protect our history.
The thing is with you, Gilbert, I mean, you're a fire captain and a cultural specialist. Does that change your mindset from that of a fire captain who is concerned strictly about getting the flames out ASAP?
When that comes to me and my dad's point of view, yes. You know, his mindset is protect all sites at all costs. And being as I have that background in fire, I know that we're not always going to save all the sites. There's going to be times where we need to save people's life. And if it costs losing a site over it because we can't get to it or we don't have the personnel to do that, then that's where it gets kind of hard because we have two jobs to do. And cultural sites are important to us. But my number one job that I'm hired to do is firefighter.
We keep hearing that this Thomas fire is historic in terms of scale and damage. Have you ever seen anything like what we're seeing right now?
No, it's burning really fast and fires are getting really big. I mean, I haven't seen anything like this, you know, since Zacka fire in 2007. No fire's ever the same, but every year it just seems like it's getting worse and worse.
Gilbert Romero is a fire captain and cultural specialist for the Chumash Fire Department in California. Thanks very much for speaking with us, and stay safe out there. Best of luck.
Okay, thank you.
Last week, 92 Somali immigrants were loaded onto a deportation flight headed for Somalia. They were shackled and reportedly had no access to a bathroom or adequate food and water. When their plane touched down in Senegal in West Africa for refueling, they remained on the plane, and then all 92 of them were flown not onto Somalia, but back to the U.S. Attorney Kimberly Hunter represents two of the Somali immigrants on that flight. She told us what happened to the people on the plane and why they were brought back.
Basically, conditions on the plane, if one of my colleagues characterized them as slave ship conditions. Our clients and 90 others left Louisiana on a charter flight bound for Africa. They left at about 5 in the morning on Thursday morning. By Friday morning, we were receiving calls that the plane was coming back. Friday night, about midnight, they had in fact returned to Miami. During the flight, they were shackled hands and feet for the entire duration. ICE disputes accounts about lack of adequate food, water, and restrooms, although those inadequacies are consistent with reports that we've had from our clients and others. By the time they got back to the United States, of course, they were exhausted, having been in an airline seat, shackled hands and feet for nearly 2 days. And it was another 4 hours or so after their arrival in Miami before they even had an opportunity to lie down at what is now the Chrome Detention Facility in Miami, Florida.
Why did the plane come back in the first place from Senegal?
There are three different versions of the story about why the plane returned from Senegal. There is the official ICE version, which states that the relief flight crew was not able to get sufficient rest, so they were held on the tarmac to allow the crew to rest, and subsequently, due to, quote, logistical concerns, returned to the U.S. The men in the plane were being told that there was a part that needed to come to fix the plane. That part had to come from the United States, and that's why they were being ground stopped in Senegal. Thirdly, Somalia media reports, and I personally find this the most credible, that due to the ongoing protests that were taking place in Mogadishu and in Djibouti pertaining to the Jerusalem decision by this administration, the security situation just became completely untenable as far as allowing that flight to land.
On average, Kimberly, how many years had the Somalis on this flight lived in the U.S.?
Well, I can speak for our clients, and I believe the majority are probably in a similar situation, between 15 to 20 years. I think the thing that's the most noteworthy about it is the fact that many of these individuals, including my two clients, had no criminal records whatsoever.
I was just about to ask.
So these were men who had failed asylum claims from the early 90s, early 2000s. They were checking in on a regular basis with ICE officials. In one case, my client, Mr. Ibrahim, married a permanent resident, father of four children, put himself through school, was working as a cardiovascular technician at the Mayo Clinic, and was shocked, of course, to report in September and be held for pending deportation.
And the rest of this group of detainees, what can you tell us about them? Where were they living in the U.S.?
They're mainly coming from the places in the United States that have a significant Somali population. There were eight or so from Atlanta, at least eight from the Twin Cities, for example, several from Ohio. They were either a mix of people who came to the U.S. without documents, in the case of my two clients, and requested asylum but were denied. Or in some cases, they would have entered the U.S. typically as refugees but had a criminal issue that then caused them to lose their status.
Kimberly, there was a big truck bomb last month that killed 400 people in Mogadishu. The U.S. has stepped up in a major way its airstrikes on Somali targets, and we've got 500 troops there. Somalia is still a dangerous place. Why would the U.S. send these people back to such a danger zone?
Well, the U.S. stands alone in that regard, along with Israel. Other westernized democracies are not removing to Somalia for that very reason. I think it's reflective of the Trump administration's both overall crackdown on immigration, as well as they're very reflective of their attitude towards Somalia and towards Muslims. In the case of Mr. Ibrahim, in the case of Mr. Ibrahim, he, in theory, would be allowed to return to the United States because his wife could file and petition for him, but he's got no way to actually return now or who knows into the near future with the fact that the Somali travel ban has recently been allowed to continue.
As you said, these detainees are currently in Miami. Is the plan still deportation?
That is what has been communicated to them within the detention center. The rumblings are there will be a flight attempt again on Wednesday. Yes.
Attorney Kimberly Hunter speaking with us from St. Paul, Minnesota. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
First of all, for this next story, a pro tip from my British colleagues. It's not mincemeat pies. They are filled with so-called mincemeat, but the pies themselves are mince pies. And if you're in the UK, you would never make that mistake. And if you're in the UK, you're probably seeing a whole new take on mince pies, as ubiquitous as pumpkin anything here during Thanksgiving or eggnog here right now. And as a one-bite pie, so much more portable than anything we got. Our number one British colleague, Leo Hornack at the BBC in London, has been investigating mince pie 2.0. First of all, some definitions, Leo. What is mincemeat and what is a mince pie?
Well, I mean, the first thing I think, Marco, to be clear about is that, as you say, they don't have any mince in them.
So mince is a type of meat.
Exactly. Yeah. Mince is a type of meat normally. But in this case, it's a name which goes back to medieval times when they did have meat in them. They did have lamb or beef, and that's kind of faded away over the centuries, but we still call them that. And just to sort of give you, our listeners, a little image, just picture like a tiny kind of like an apple pie for a doll's house, short crust pastry covered in sugar, and inside baked raisins, cinnamon, cloves, nutmeg, kind of spices, and a ton of sugar, and maybe a bit of brandy if it's not for the kids.
Yeah, no, it's really delicious. I love them. How important are they to a British Christmas?
My question really was, why aren't they a part of an American Christmas? That seems to me, you know, what part of a pastry snack covered in sugar designed for overeating doesn't sound like it would work in the States?
What part of that don't you understand?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the myth is that the Crusaders brought back the idea of using spices with meat back from the Middle East. And as I said, that was then baked into pies as a way of making the meat taste more interesting. It was a Christmas tradition, and the meat element just sort of faded away until we're left with this thing that completely dominates Christmas here.
And it continues to evolve, the old mince pie. What are you seeing?
Well, I mean, what I'm seeing is a sort of takeover of Christmas by mince pies. And I think that's in the last few years. I'm in a kind of open planned office here, and I stood up at my desk this morning just thinking about this, and I looked, and every direction I looked in, I was surrounded by mince pies on desks. And the problem is, I mean, that's not a problem. It's a great thing.
That doesn't
the
sound problem, like a
problem is, me. Yeah, when there is such a demand, we end up with novelty. And what's happened is people have been trying to bring their own spin on the pie. And I've brought a few things. I haven't tested them before, but this is a kind of political pie. This is something that's only existed this year. It's from a French bakery, and they've done something which I think it's quite easy to read the Brexit message in this. It is a pie bread. It is a mixture between a croissant and a mince pie. It looks like a croissant. It walks like a croissant, but it's got this bits of sort of, well, what we would call mincemeat sticking out of it. I'm just going to have a little taste now.
How's it?
That's really good.
I hear the crunch of the choux pastry. It sounds perfect.
I was ready to be snobby about this, but...
No longer.
That's like a weird... It's very EU, because this is also tastes a bit like a Danish.
What else do you have on the table?
Now, I got in touch with one of London's poshest butchers, and what they have done is they've attempted to recreate the original medieval mince pie. Now, this thing in front of me here... It's a huge thing. It comes in a metal tray. You could probably live on this. It looks huge. And I'm just going to cut into it and take a little slice.
Okay.
So this has got beef in it. This is what people would have meant by mince pie.
This is going
My ancestors would have. Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to hang on a sec.
Wow, it must be a really big pie. It sounds like you can barely fit it in the studio. You have a saw? How big is this thing?
Wow. Marco, I love my job. Yeah, this looks like you could use it to insulate a building. I mean, it looks substantial.
How's it, the old school
it's
version?
It's also delicious, Marco. Mm. It's amazing.
So after looking around your office at the BBC and seeing all these kind of mass-produced little mince pies, what you're tasting now, is it enough to make you want to make your own authentic homemade mince pie? And
well,
if so, what do you do?
I'm embarrassed to say I'm not much of a cook when it comes to baking. So I've never made my own mince pies, but I have been told that there is a good tip. And this came from someone I really trust on this. This is not the medieval one. This is a homemade modern British mince pie. And the real thing is to make sure you put more brandy in than you think.
Gotcha.
I mean, I've got one last one to share with you, Marco. There is something I saw in the street where the BBC office is. I was walking past it and... This is a mince pie flat white. Mm. They have taken the essence of a mince pie and put it into some coffee.
Wow.
And so it's, I don't know, this must need sort of NASA level technology.
I think it's more like pumpkin technology.
Okay, I'm just going to try this now.
What are you doing, Leo?
That is vile.
Okay.
That is really, really, that's not right. That's not right at all. You can't do that to coffee. And you can't do that to a mince pie or me, frankly.
Well, I certainly appreciate you taking a bullet for us today and being our personal tester on these mince pies. Leo Hornack at the BBC in London on the mince pie beat today. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman's voice clone, and you're listening to The World. Do you think I sound like you, Marco?
Yes, Marco, you do if you just came back from the dentist with a mouth full of Novocaine.
You totally sound like that, Marco. Kind of.
Get the cotton out. Anyway, I created my voice clone via a computer program created by a Montreal startup called Lyrebird, L-Y-R-E Bird.
Yep.
Pretty cool stuff, maybe pretty scary stuff too. But where does this all come from? When did this whole replicating human speech thing begin? Nina Porzucchi, you've been looking into this. You host our World in Words podcast.
Humans have been trying to synthesize speech for a very long time. So there are stories about automatons speaking since the medieval times. But more modern, well, frankly, more scientific efforts at speech synthesis date back to the 18th century. And then fast forward a couple of centuries. Meet the voter, V-O-D-E-R. It was created in Bell Laboratories by an acoustic engineer, Homer Dudley. The voter debuted at the New York World's Fair in 1939. It was the first attempt to electronically replicate talking by breaking down speech into 20 different sounds.
For example, Helen, will you have the voter say, "She saw me"?
She saw me.
That sounded awfully flat. How about a little expression? Who saw you?
She saw me.
Whom did she see?
She saw me.
Well, did she see you or hear you?
The first computer speech synthesis programs began in the 1950s. And then in 1968, Bell Laboratories made headlines again by making a computer sing.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer.
This song, of course, was made more famous by HAL 9000's demise, or I should say deactivation, in 2001 Space Odyssey.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, do. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you.
Oh, that is so sad. I've forgotten how sad that scene is. And then Dave is stranded in time and space.
It's the saddest scene. It is very emotional. Hal's dying voice is emotional. Voice is emotional. Yeah. And this is something that the founders of Lyrebird, they noticed. That's the company that you mentioned, Marco, the one that helped you digitize your own voice. So I can hear all of you out there screaming at your radio, fake news! And we get into that, all of that, this week on the podcast.
It is very, very real. You can find the World in Words podcast.
Wait, Marco, I'll take it from here.
And I'm off to the unemployment office. Okay, take it away, Marco, voice clone.
No worries. I come in peace, Marco. Subscribe to the World in Words on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Now back to the show.
We're so dead. Finally today, another A-side, B-side. I love these segments we've been doing with the world's Brandi Fullwood. She's been collaborating with Smithsonian's Folklife Festival. So for the A-side, Brandi selects a track from the archives of the Smithsonian's music collection, and then she toggles to a related track that has been in her ears lately. Today on A-side, B-side, though, Brandi's hearing a lot more than music.
There are so many found sounds in the Smithsonian archives, like this typewriter. This is not a music selection from the archives, but a documentation of office life. In the future, it might help us understand what life was like before the robots took over. The sounds range from office sounds to crying babies to insects to city life. So I was curious about the different kinds of music made by adapting found sounds. The term water drum in Western Africa is often associated with a drum made from a floating calabash or gourd that drummers play with sticks. Here, the musicians are playing the water itself. The drumming still brings in percussion and even a sharper texture from the smack of hands onto the surface. There are a number of ways to adapt the found sound of water to create the water drum. Whether it's with sticks or just hitting the water, the literal found sound has no bounds. Okay, the B-side. Remember the typewriter from the archives? Well, it's not actually what you're going to hear in the song, but there is a converted typewriter featured in it.
Peace.
Kokoko is a Congolese collective making a lot of experimental music with found sounds and objects, from typewriters to glass bottles. They feature a variety of instruments like guitars made from metal tin cans to upright harps made of coffee cans. The group is interested in electronic music, but they have said they don't have the means to produce all the sounds they'd like. Instead, their songs come together with a sound inspired by their city, Kinshasa. It's rhythmic and imaginative in ways that even bends the expectations of experimental or improvisational sound. For the world, I'm Brandy Fullwood.
Now, that is a great way to end the week. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. You have yourselves a great weekend, and see you back here on Monday.
Public Radio International.